Well, good evening. Please open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, and we're going to take our study this evening from verses 9 through 13. Verses 9 through 13. It has been a wonderful, short but wonderful weekend with you all already. I enjoyed eating lunch with some of you all this afternoon, and certainly look forward to getting to know some of you all after services as well. It's been great to get to talk to you all and spend time with you guys. Very excited about what we're going to talk about tonight. But before we go ahead and get into the content, what I want to ask you to go ahead and do from the beginning is I want you to think of three different people. I'm sure you've already started to think of these things, knowing that Brent Hunter was here this past weekend. But I want you to think of three different people with whom you would like to share the gospel. But I want you, as you think of these three different names, and I don't really normally trust my memory, so if you want to write them down, that would be great. Make a note in your phone. You're welcome to do that. But I want you to be thinking of these three names and be realistic to your own perspective as you consider these three names. Think of people or write down the names of three people who you really, in your heart, believe you've got a chance to teach them the gospel, that they will give a yes when you ask if they would like to study with you. And we're going to return to that in a little bit and do a little bit of analysis of those names and see what we come up with. Matthew chapters 8 through 9 are filled with short narratives of Jesus healing and interacting with and teaching different types of people. Different types of people that were quite unlikely for him to interact with. People that the Jews would normally avoid. For example, if you want to turn back to chapter 8, you can notice at the beginning of chapter 8, Jesus touched a leper to heal him. And then in verses 5 through 13, he healed a centurion servant, a Gentile servant. And then in verses 14 through 17, you see there he heals many people, including just a woman, which would not have been on the high up list of people revered by the Jews and of all those people. Now here in chapter 9, Jesus is going to interact with some more unlikely people in our narrative today. What Matthew is doing is he's using these different narratives to teach his audience about the unlikely types of people that will be in the kingdom of heaven, the people that the religious of that day did not expect to be in the kingdom of heaven. So like all people, the religious elite of Jesus' day enjoyed spending their time and surrounding themselves with similarly minded people, other religious people, other Jews. That's who they enjoyed interacting with. But Jesus is interesting because as we consider his ministry, as you think of the different narratives here and in other places, who did he spend a lot of his time with? Well, people completely unlike him. See, you and I like to surround ourselves with people. It's comfortable for all of us to surround ourselves with people that are like us. I would say maybe moral and religious people that are like us. It's easy. We get them. They get us. It's easy. But doesn't that kind of hurt us as we consider doing evangelism, as we consider spreading the good news to sinful, dying, sick people in the world? That's kind of the question I want to put to you tonight. It's the question we're going to be thinking about and considering today, because I believe that today's story is going to teach us to show a greater concern for and change our interactions around those we might label as sinners. Not that we're all not sinners, but people that are clearly apart from God. Christ, what we're doing tonight, Christ is the master teacher. And doesn't he often do things we might not think of? He teaches people that we might normally avoid. And he teaches them in ways and uses different methods that we don't normally think of. And so simply what I want to do tonight as we consider verses 9 through 13 is I want to consider, how did Jesus teach people? How did he interact with people? Who did he interact with? And maybe we can learn some things for ourselves today. Because our goal is to seek the same people Jesus sought and teach them in similar ways that he did. So notice with me the text for this evening, verses 9 through 13 of Matthew 9. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." So in a portion of Scripture where Matthew is emphasizing the unlikely people that will be in the kingdom of heaven, the unlikely people that Jesus associated with, isn't it funny? He tells the story of his own conversion and his own call to follow Christ. And isn't it amazing how fast Matthew just hops right up from his tax booth, sets everything aside, and follows Jesus. But what I want to focus on tonight is how amazing it is that Jesus calls Matthew the tax collector at all. Think about it. Who are tax collectors? What was their position? Well, tax collectors were hated people in that area. Their occupation aligned them with the hated Rome. They collected taxes and they sent them right on to Caesar, their oppressor. But it's even worse. It's not just their occupation, but it's how they performed their occupation. See, tax collectors collected taxes for Rome, but they were known for collecting extra taxes, extorting, taking extra money from these families, from their own brothers, from their own Jewish brothers, and lining their own pockets. And so here's the picture. Jesus called a tax collector, he called a greedy, dishonest thief to be his apostle, to be one of his apostles. That's pretty shocking. But as we go on and we notice what happens there in verse 10, Luke's account tells us that Matthew holds this party, by the way, this dinner party. We find out that Jesus doesn't just call one apostle that is a sinner, a known sinner, to be his one of his apostles. He eats with an entire group of tax collectors and sinners. He was reclining at table with them. So that means that they weren't eating at a McDonald's or a quick meal. Reclining at table was the common posture of banqueting. So he is banqueting. He is at a big meal eating with sinners and tax collectors, people that had, in a sense, by their lifestyle, rejected God. That's who he's eating with. I want you to picture that scene for a moment, by the way. Think about that. The Son of God eating, conversing, laughing with the people labeled as sinners in the city. But the funny part is that, though we might think, well, that must be very uncomfortable, right? Well, it's not Jesus or his disciples that are uncomfortable with this situation. Notice, who is it that's uncomfortable with this situation there in verse 11? It's the Pharisees. They are appalled that Christ would do such a thing. They say, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Meaning, how in the world could he think to do that, associate with such people? And that's what it meant, by the way. When you ate with something, it connoted, as Grant Osborne says, it means something more than our meals today. He says, meals were important social occasions in the first century. For Jesus and his disciples to eat with such people was scandalous. It meant they were accepting these tax collectors and identifying with them and sinners. So Jesus was associating with his people. He knew exactly what he was doing when he was eating with them. But we shouldn't be too harsh on the Pharisees. Just want to glance this really quick. We shouldn't be too harsh on them, because how would we feel today if Jesus returned to the earth and spent a few years on the earth and he didn't bother with any of us and he only bothered with the prostitutes and the addicts of the world and spent time with them? if I'm honest, when I first thought about that happening and tried to put myself in that situation, I was pretty offended. I was pretty offended to think about that. I've been working hard. Jesus, what you doing, man? Hanging out with all these other people. Why not us? And so they are appalled that Jesus is hanging out with these sinners. They are upset. That's the precedent Jesus set when he came to earth in the first century, spending time with sinners. Why, though? Why does he do this? That's the question that the Pharisees ask. And I want you to notice why. Why would he spend the time with people so impure and dirty with sin? Well, notice what he says in verses 12 to 13. He directly answers it. He says, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." I believe this statement is quite simple, but it is very profound the more I think of it. And as we consider Christ's methods of teaching, this is who he teaches. He teaches the sick people. Though we might expect him to spend time with religious people when he came to earth, the precedent he set here was to spend time with sick people. His argument is, well, I came in the world to call sinners. Why do I need to spend my time with people who are either healthy or at least think they are healthy? What is the need for that? There is no need for Jesus to do this. He is a spiritual physician. The physician is here. Who's he going to go to? Sick people. It's natural. If Christ came to the world to heal sinners, then I believe that this is who we ought to focus on teaching as well. People that are sinners. And we might say, well, who else are we going to teach, Scott? Who else are we going to teach? We're all sinners, right? Well, think about, who do we normally spend our gospel sharing efforts on? What types of people do we often seek to fill our churches with? Often, if I'm not mistaken, when we picture a thriving church, we picture no new, weak, troubled, addiction-troubled lives with sin. We don't picture sinners in our congregations, do we? Struggling to overcome sin. That's not what I picture when I picture a thriving congregation. I think everybody's top-notch, mature for years. In fact, I want you to think about the three people that you wrote down or thought about in your mind. What types of people were they? How many of them would you say that you would consider, you would really respect them as good, moral, religious people? See, at least when I consider myself, oftentimes, the people I put in my mind for who I would like to teach are people that I think are just 99% of the way there. They're just about a Christian, but not quite there. And really what we find out is oftentimes they end up becoming quite religiously satisfied people, people that don't even recognize their own sin, happy with themselves. And so I'd ask you, as we consider who we ought to teach and who we ought to put on our list, on our radar, what are churches supposed to be? Are we a place that is a hospital for sinners or a hotel for saints? Who are we? I believe that this question gets to the heart of Jesus' statement there in verse 12. Notice it again. Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Just imagine what would happen for a moment if all the hospitals in the area, they kind of got together, leadership and all the nurses, they just had a lot of complaints. There were too many sick people coming in, and so they just said, they put out a statement to the public. Tell you what, guys, we're kind of really overwhelmed right now. So what we're going to do is no more sick people come into our hospitals, just healthy people. What's going to happen? Well, they're going to be empty. Their hospital is absolutely pointless, and it is not fulfilling its mission. Though we are designed, congregations, families are designed to be hospitals for sin-sick people, why is it that so often people who are really sinners, people who are really struggling, feel quite uncomfortable among us? Maybe because of an attitude, maybe because of how we've handled them, maybe how we might not have reached out to them. Why is it that they struggle feeling comfortable? Why is it that those are the people we actually struggle oftentimes pursuing with our teaching efforts? We struggle oftentimes, at least I struggle oftentimes, when I see someone afflicted with addictions and afflicted with all kinds of messed up worldviews, I wonder, does Jesus even want them? We know he wants them. We need to replicate Christ's ministry and focus on the people that he focused on. And consider, just notice how quickly, as we brought out, how quickly Matthew jumps up from his tax collecting booth. He knows he is a dirty sinner, but he knows he wants to change. I was talking with someone this afternoon, goes and teaches in the prisons, and he said, man, those people, they know what's wrong. They know what's in our lives. And it's not just people that are in prisons that are like that. There's other people in the world who are afflicted, and they know it. It does not mean that we cannot teach religious people that have some things messed up. It doesn't mean that at all. Christ came to save all people, and in fact, he taught a few Pharisees, didn't he, and converted a few. That's just fine. But when we put an undue focus on people who are already religiously satisfied, or an undue focus on moral religious people, and forget the sinners of the world and don't want to teach them, we forget the people that Jesus focused on when he came to the earth. We need to remember, Christ came to save sinners. Let's focus our teaching efforts on the same people he focused on. There's a second thing I think we notice from this passage is that Jesus befriends, he relates to sinners. We see that there in verse 10. He reclined at table with them. He ate with them. And so I don't believe that we can only just learn from whom Jesus taught, but from how Jesus taught. Certainly in this particular situation, he is not directly teaching these people at this moment, but I find it hard to believe that he didn't end up taking that opportunity. Sometimes he taught people that he just met. We want to certainly put that in scope. Jesus taught many different types of people. Sometimes he taught people he just met. But isn't it interesting that we notice here that Jesus took the opportunity to befriend sinners and get to know them? Matthew chapter 11 and verse 19 says, what happens there is Jesus speaks about how people are slanderously calling him, what? A friend of tax collectors and sinners. You know, they thought that was a slanderous statement, but I think that was a true statement, wasn't it? We can see that here in this text. He was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. This is significant for us to think about then. Before Jesus taught people, sometimes and oftentimes, he had a relationship with them. He got to know them. He came down on their level. And I believe this is often our most crucial mistake. It's my most crucial mistake. We don't love to befriend sinners. That's not that much fun, is it? Who here really loves being around sinful people? Sinful people. It's not too easy. I mean, sinners, they curse. They dress immodestly. They drink too much. They're materialistic. They're always sleeping with some new person, always going around from one marriage to the next. They're different. They make us uncomfortable. Don't I sound self-righteous saying that? That's how we sound in our own minds, Christians. To take the first step towards teaching sinners, we must stop looking at them with those harsh attitudes that I just expressed, because we would be just as sinful if someone did not take the patience to spend time with us and help us grow and help us overcome those weaknesses and help us overcome our sin-sick, afflicted lives. We needed the same patience. We must love sinners. Certainly. Christ wants us to spend time with our spiritual family. He is, in a sense, creating a spiritual family for us to help one another grow. That's a wonderful thing. But just because he is helping us have a new spiritual family here, does not mean he desires to rip us out of all of our social spheres and take us away from every sinner and every opportunity that we've ever known. That's not what he's trying to do. It's not what he's trying to do. How else is Jesus going to reach the people in our workplace, the people in our school, the people we come in contact in our recreational activities or our hobbies, the things that we do from day to day? How else is Christ going to teach them? Can I teach them, the people at your workplace? Can you teach the people in my neighborhood? No. You're it, Christian. I'm it. That's the only way. How else, as Romans says, as Paul says in Romans, how else is someone going to hear unless someone preaches the gospel to them? And so I would urge you then, instead of avoiding people in these situations, instead of avoiding real relationships with these people, build relationships with them. Build relationships with these sinners in school, sinners at work, sinners in your neighborhood, sinners in your day-to-day life. And you might say, well, I don't need any friends. Yes, we do. We might not need it, but they need it. They need a real friend. Make many friends who are sinners. Maybe just start with a couple of people, but end up making many friends who are sinners because you love their souls. And that's where I want to make an important point about this. We're not just making, some people talk about this like, oh, I've got a sinner friend, and they'll throw out some kind of sin, and you know, they're really gleeful about it as if it's some kind of badge of acceptance and postmodernism on their lapel. No, that's not what we're seeking to do here. We're not just trying to say, I've got sinner friends. We're doing this for the purpose of saving their souls, loving them. We don't get close to sinners just to be close to the world and say, hey, I'm okay with it. We get close to sinners to affect their hearts with sin. And so as you create these relationships, I urge you, affect them. Don't let them affect you. You be the instigator of change. I think a second thing that we see Jesus do, and I think it's a simple thing, is he eats with sinners. You might already say, actually, I've got a lot of sinner friends. Many of you may already be in that situation. Actually, I've got a lot of sinner friends. And I would say to you, start seeking an opportunity to teach them. And we might respond, well, we're not quite at that level yet. Not, you know, that would be kind of the, I'm not quite close enough to them yet. Do what Jesus did here. Do what Matthew did here. It's Luke 5:29 that tells us that it was Levi, or as he's also called, Matthew, who held this dinner party. That's what's interesting. Jesus calls Matthew from his tax booth, and you know what he does? Is he has a party, invites all of his sinner friends over, all his tax collector friends from work. Hey, come meet Jesus. Come meet him. Come meet his disciples. What a wonderful way for him to, in a low-pressure way, introduce his friends in a low-pressure way to the one who might eventually save their souls. Now we can't exactly replicate that, can we? We can't invite people over to physically meet Jesus. That's not really going to work. But I think we can seek to replicate it in various ways. I think we can seek to copy it in various ways and just learn from the principle of what happens here. I think one way that we can seek to replicate this is by opening up our homes and opening up our homes to more diverse groups. Oftentimes when I think about having dinner parties or having a 4th of July thing or a New Year's Eve thing, the first and only thing I pull out is the church directory, and I go down that list, and that's who I invite. Man, let's have some mixed parties. That's what they had here, some sinners, some Christians. And what happens there? Is there is a building of relationships. There's an opportunity for them to come in contact with people completely unlike them, people that have this unfound joy in trials, unfound surpassing joy that doesn't have to be found in filling up in the things of this world. They get the opportunity just to be around those people, and you get to know them better as well. You invite them into your home as well. Isn't that a neat thing that we can do? Our culture is increasingly growing separate from one another. If I'm in a neighborhood, whenever I first moved into West Palm Beach, we were in the neighborhood, and we moved into a house in which we'd had friends and relatives that had lived in that same house in the past, and one of the ladies came over to say, "Hi, you know, we've always been good friends with the people across over here." And I said, "Well, man, we'll have to get together sometime and get to know each other." She said, whoa, not that close. We're increasingly going separate in our lifestyles, and we need to change that culture if we want to get close to people, close enough to talk about their souls, to talk about eternity with them. And so that's a suggestion. I like throwing out tools, and I believe this is one tool that we can use. It opens up the opportunity for spiritual discussions to even happen in those situations. Not that we force them, but it provides that opportunity. The door is open to move further. And before we move on from that, I'd say there's a second way that maybe we could that we could do this, that we could mimic what happens here. What we do in West Palm Beach is we do these monthly or weekly or bi-weekly community group studies. We get together in someone's home. I hear sometimes you guys do similar things like this. It's a great opportunity for us to study the Bible. It might be Song of Solomon, kind of a hot topic, romantic love, or Revelation. That gets people excited in the community. What's the dragon about? What's the stars falling down about? What's all this about? Or it could be a topical study. It could be something about parenting. It could be commonly asked questions and answers, something we're doing now. And it's an easy way, if we do these things, you know, for a certain period of time, we say, hey, we're ramping up excitement about this study. You can invite your friends into it. And when they come in, it's this low-pressure setting. We're sitting in a circle, kind of like what you guys do in your study, sitting in a circle, informal environment. And let's be honest, it's a little bit less intimidating because we're not all as dressed up in those situations. We're just kind of wearing jeans and just wearing polos, and it's calmed down. It's easy for them to feel welcome. It's easy for them to feel comfortable in that situation. And we get up afterwards. Maybe we eat some food together, have some good conversations. And it starts really, even in a more direct way than just these dinner parties, in a more direct way, giving them the opportunity to, in a very low-pressure way, come to know Jesus and come to know his people. All of this would be foolish, by the way, if we stopped there, wouldn't it? It's not evangelism to have someone in your home to eat with them, is it? But what are we doing? We're trying to build a bridge. We're trying to create relationships. And so in those first two points, what I'm just urging each of us to do is to start having a more conscious effort, put forth a more conscious effort to connect to people in our day-to-day lives in such a way that it won't be awkward when we talk about eternity. It won't be awkward when we talk about Jesus. And so once we begin coming close with people, I believe that the next step is to teach them. We don't know how Matthew and Jesus went on to teach these tax collector friends. We don't know exactly what they did, but I think in many ways it doesn't matter because there are so many ways to find an opportunity to teach people. I would submit to you, if you grow nervous, the one thing that helps me is I consider, oh man, I start getting nervous. I got the three names in my head. I know how I'm going to get close to them. Gulp, the next step is to teach them. Start praying about it. Start praying about it, praying to the Lord to help him, help you, asking him to help you see a good opportunity, a good comfortable opportunity to talk to them about spiritual things. Pray to him. I guarantee you, he's going to answer. He wants those souls more than you want those souls. I find every time he answers those prayers. When I ask for opportunities, I end up becoming overwhelmed with the amount of opportunities, something that's happening in West Palm Beach right now at the moment. But when we start praying for those things, God is going to answer. And then our eyes are going to even be more open to talking about spiritual things with them, bringing up things, allowing discussions to happen. And when we start talking about spiritual things with them just in conversational ways, their interest, if they are desirous of these things, their interest is going to be piqued. They might ask you a question, and that's the perfect time to seize on the moment and say, hey, you know, we should go get coffee and actually talk about that, because that is kind of a big question. Why do people suffer? How could we say there is a good God? when people suffer or whatever their question may be. So you could go get coffee with them and have a simple discussion over coffee. We don't have to make it into a big ordeal thing. If you don't feel comfortable quite yet inviting them to worship, you can do just a personal study with them. And by the way, be important then for us to get to know our Bibles. That's why it's so important for us to get to know our Bibles, so we feel comfortable with talking with people about these things and learning how to do these things. Or if you don't feel comfortable and you desire to have someone else do it for the time while you sit in, you could say, as Brent talked about, hey, you know, my friend, he loves to do these big picture presentations. It's this overview of the Bible, and I think it's really neat. Would you be interested in doing that? And that might answer some of those questions we've been talking about. They say, yeah, that actually sounds really interesting. I kind of look at the Bible, and it's just this big conglomeration of things, and I don't really know what it's about. I would love to do that. Or you can invite them to a community group study. So the whole point is to take these relationships from the physical to the spiritual and find an opportunity to get them taught, whether it's you teaching them or someone else who has more strengths at that, and you need more time to develop the ability to teach. And just do whatever feels most comfortable to you in those situations. Just pick whatever method feels most comfortable to you. If you've got another method of doing that, then that's great. Take whatever opportunity you can. And you might be scared of them saying no, but I submit to you that if we've eaten a meal with them, if we're close to them, if we're really friends with them, it's pretty tough. I'm amazed at how many friends say yes. It's pretty tough for them to say no. We might start getting nervous as we think about these things, but I want you to remember, as you feel inadequate, remember, all of us are inadequate. All of us are quite inadequate. I kind of had one of those little moments this week after one of my studies with a friend, and she brought all these people I didn't expect to the study, and let me tell you, that study, I didn't feel so great about it afterwards. I felt pretty inadequate. We're always going to feel inadequate at times. There are going to be times where we feel this is too much. But here's the funny thing. You know what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 through 5? He essentially says he talks about how he wasn't really that great of a speaker. He trembled when he spoke, as I referenced this morning. Isn't that amazing? One of the greatest evangelists that the world has ever known, and he trembled when he spoke, and he did not have a great presence. You might wonder, like Moses, I wasn't made to speak. You can learn. And if Paul can do it and have a great effect, then we can do it. Why? Because where's the power? It's in the gospel. It's in that awesome gospel of Jesus Christ. And the great thing about teaching people from the world is that they're going to often do the same thing that Matthew did. Brent, my brother, taught a couple years ago this girl named Tierra, and as we've discipled her and helped her grow, it's been amazing. She hasn't left all her social spheres, and I guarantee she could probably list off 20 people that she is already that she's been thinking about, and I could list off 8 or 9 that she's already brought to our regular studies. This works out to just multiply. You just teach a couple of sinners in the world, you could easily have access to 20 opportunities with 20 more people that they definitely have close relationships with, and they are definitely excited about. They've got that newborn faith, and they want to share it with them. So just start with teaching one of your sinner friends. If each of us just taught one of our sinner friends, imagine the explosion that would happen. You know, that's why there was an explosion back in Acts. That's why there was an explosion. People left Jerusalem and they told everybody about what they could not keep their lips shut about. It's very interesting how the gospel can spread so easily if we'll just sow the seed. But I believe there's still a great danger that we need to talk about. As we talk about teaching sinners, as we talk about associating with and spending our time with sinners, I want you to notice again what the Pharisees said there in verse 11. Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? They were quite unhappy about this. They thought, well, how could Christ justify spending time with such people? And I want to submit to you that it is so easy for us, and we might say this lightly, but we need to be quite serious about this. We are at danger of becoming the new Pharisees. there is a religiously elite attitude that is spreading through many conservative churches that is extremely prevalent today that says, I just can't justify associating with such people. They are so vile and wicked. In a completely different place, completely different time, nobody that anyone would ever know here, I overheard a conversation that was quite disturbing. Someone who was an evangelist was saying that he needed to get out of Tampa and into Bowling Green because there were just too many sinners in Tampa. It was just too dirty. There are just too many wicked people in Tampa. Things like this are often said to not just say, well, this is my decision, but to promote that decision over other people who decide to stay in Corinth, to stay in sinful areas, to stay with sinful people. And they're promoting themselves over others. I want to ask you a question. It's a question I keep putting to myself. Who is more Christ-like? The person who removes themselves from all their social spheres, or the person who stays in those social spheres so they can affect people's hearts with Christ? Who is more Christ-like? Who is more loving? The person who spends time with sinners and builds relationships with sinners so that they can teach them, or the person who either avoids them or just keeps relationships with them just for the fun of it? Who loves them more? Who is more Christ-like? The answer is pretty easy to that. We are not better if we say, I can't justify allowing myself or my kids to be around sinful people. Because from the time kids are young, they need to be taught that they are not just here on earth to be good moral people, but to change the world through Jesus Christ's gospel. That's what we are here for. And the reason we often have people leaving the faith as they grow up, becoming less excited about the faith growing up, is because from the time they were born, there, as one person has said this weekend, it's a consumer-driven Christianity as opposed to a kingdom-driven Christianity. What are we here? Are we a kingdom or a club? A club gets together and surrounds one another with, hey, we have a common interest, all right, but a kingdom goes and conquers. The kingdom goes and spreads the border. That's the purpose of a kingdom. We are a kingdom, not a club. That's why Jesus Christ came here. That's our purpose here, Christians. And so if you honestly, as many of us do, recognize this difficulty, this Pharisaic tendency in our hearts, hope's not lost. Look at verse 13. Jesus is teaching them and saying these things for a reason. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Though we might think it is better to feign a superior righteousness by shunning worldly people, Christ tells us to be merciful to these people and love them by spending time with them, because he's a physician, and the only way they're going to come to know the physician is if we tell them about him. Would you tell someone who had cancer, if no one knew about a doctor, you were the only one who knew about the doctor, and you find out someone's got cancer, you're not going to lead them right to that doctor? We've got a much worse situation on our own hands than physical sicknesses. We've got real sickness going on in people's hearts and lives. People are dying. This is the world of the walking dead. The zombie apocalypse has happened, folks. It's here. It's upon us. If we look down on the sinful people, we are the self-righteous people that Jesus avoided. Let's not be those people. Let us learn mercy. Why? Because Jesus showed us mercy. Jesus showed us mercy. And as we talked about this morning, what's always our motivation to change? Jesus. God, what he has done for us. And so that is your motivation. That is all of our motivation, to start showing mercy and loving sinners. when we think about evangelism, we need to think like Christ did. Though we naturally think we should seek out highly moral people, Christ came to save sinners. And so let's start surrounding ourselves with the people Christ surrounded himself with, sinners. He ate with them, happily associated with them. And when you are tempted to follow the religiously elite attitude that says, I can't do this, I must separate from sinners, remember, that is not what Jesus did. He came to call not righteous, but sinners to salvation. After all, when we talk about salvation, we're not talking about someone who doesn't need saved from anything. They need saving from something big, something terrible. So focus your evangelistic efforts. If we're going to try to pinpoint a message for tonight, focus your evangelistic efforts on people who are sinners. Introduce Christ to them for the first time, and they will remember you forever. Jesus will change their life. He will bring so much joy to their life, just as we have had joy enter into our lives, joy that no one can take away, eternity that no one can take away. Let's spread the tidings round as we all sang about this evening. If there's any way we can help you in your walk with Jesus Christ, if there's any way we can help you overcome maybe even Pharisaic thinking in your own life, or come to know Jesus Christ for the first time and come to give your life to the physician that takes away sin, we want to help you in that. You can talk to us afterwards, or you can come forward to the front while we stand and while we sing.